Writer and storyteller Jack Hitt has made a career talking about the people he's met and the stories that have arisen from that. You may have heard Jack Hitt any number of times on This American Life. Here's a little excerpt from Jack Hitt at one of his more familiar stories, I think. He's talking to Ira Glass. They're talking about, I think it was first on a show called Fiasco. Here it is.
I don't know if you remember the opening moment of Peter Pan, but it's the three little kids sleeping in their bed. And Peter Pan comes in, you know, and has the little speech where he says, anybody can fly. Why? With just a little magic dust, one can fly. Sprinkles this magic dust in the air. And sure enough, the kids lurch into the air. And it becomes clear right away that the people that they've hired to run these flying apparatuses really aren't quite clear on how they actually work. So instead of the kids sort of sailing, you know, gracefully to and fro, they sort of hang in the air like puppets. Several of them start to circumscribe these circles in the air where it's clear that the people running the machines have just sort of set them off on these kind of oval courses that spiral farther and farther out. And if you're sitting in the audience, there was clearly a sense of fear on the faces of these people. Now, this is one of the great things about audiences, especially in a live theater production, is that they're very forgiving. They want the show to work. And so everyone is sort of gripping their chair a little tightly. But there was one moment that put the audience on notice. And that's when, as the kids are sort of jerking up and down and swinging back and forth and sort of going around in these ovals, at one point, the littlest one is being flung around a little too... a little too hard. And the audience sort of sees this coming, and there's a real sense of pain as the kid suddenly does an enormous splat into the wardrobe. I mean, and it's clear that he's hurt, you know. And he comes off of it sort of, you know, a little dazed. And then, of course, he's jerked up in the air a little bit, and often a little too high, so that he's suddenly sort of in the workings. He sort of left the stage itself. He's now up there with the lights, you know. And then all of a sudden, he just sort of suddenly, he would just plummet back down to the stage and be caught up just before he hit the floor. And it was hard to watch because, as you can tell, it's an incredibly funny moment. But like I say, the audience was still in this very forgiving mode, and no one said a word.
That's Jack Hitt from the Fiasco show, which everybody remembers. And that was Ira Glass laughing. Jack Hitt is a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, This American Life, Harper's, Rolling Stone, Wired, and he's also performing a one-man show, Making Up the Truth. You said, when you and Jason, our producer, were kind of going back and forth, you said, this show is not so much about how weird stories find you, but how brain scientists now tell us that all our brains are really story-generating machines.
What brain scientists are telling us is that, you know, our brain operates on, you know, whatever it is, you know, like one-tenth of a light bulb, right?
Right.
But part of it is that we actually misperceive a great deal of reality all day long, but we perceive enough of it well that we can sort of fulfill our Darwinian commands to not get killed by late afternoon every day and somehow make it to a point in life where we can mate and reproduce.
I think the idea that misperception is as much built into what we do as perception is pretty fascinating.
It is amazing. I mean, you know, a lot of this show is about how we don't actually see reality as we think we do. The title of the show, Making Up the Truth, comes from the now known fact that the brain edits reality immediately as we see it. In some cases, whole events will happen right in front of your eyes, and your brain will simply protect you from seeing what is happening right in front of your face.
I mean, witnesses to crime are often cited in this instance, right?
Right, exactly, right. I mean, now we don't even really like to use eyewitnesses in courtrooms anymore. We'd much rather rely on closed-circuit television cameras or found sound, you know, from some nearby microphone or something, because we now know that eyewitness testimony is so often wrong.
I watched a little clip on the, mm-hmm. on your website mm-hmm. about this show where you, at one point, you are telling a story and you say, and now that was really fun telling that story and hearing from that guy there. And it's you from 4 minutes ago because people have already edited, they've already created their own perception of the show, the story, the very story you're telling?
Right. Memory happens immediately, right? We now know that essentially what the brain does is that it sort of picks little pieces of the present tense out of the air and then and stores them away in a kind of infinite shoebox of present tense nuggets.
When you say stored in an infinite shoebox, then what do you mean?
Well, we all collect these little bits of the present tense.
Of the presence.
Right. And our experiences of our lives through time become basically the way we build every piece of reality that we participate in as we move through time. So in other words, really a lot of what we see is built out of what we have already seen. So like, you know, when I walked in here, like, who knows how many presumptions were built into what you saw when I walked in here? Like, he's from the East Coast. Does he have some kind of anti-West Coast attitude?
Yeah.
And I'm looking for – no. But, you know, but if you did have that anxiety – like, I'm from the Deep South. And the anti-Yankee narrative is so built into our perceptions that almost every Northerner who comes down there suddenly finds himself the cliche Yankee because that's what we're expecting to see. And more often than not, if that's what we're expecting to see, then that's what we'll see.
How does this inform your journalism?
Well, you know, my journalism has gone through, I mean, it goes through different, I have different kinds of journalism, right? I actually do real, you know, hardcore reporting for magazines.
Yeah, I was just reading your long story about abortion and crime in South Central America.
That's right, right. So I love doing those stories. You know, I flew down to El Salvador and snuck into a prison and met one of these women who'd been jailed for 30 years for an abortion. And got into a lot of trouble for that, by the way. But I do like try to, you know, going out and trying to dig out real reality. But in the meantime, I mean, the other kind of thing that I've always done is just sort of tell these kind of crazy stories. And this show is about how I started doing that when I was a very young kid. That became sort of the thing I was known for in my neighborhood. And here's why. When I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina in the late 60s, there was a man who lived right down the street from me, very well-known kind of flamboyant fellow, Gordon Langley Hall. And when I was 10 years old, he went away for a couple of weeks. And when he came back, he was one of the first men in the world to become a woman. And the world's media descended on my neighborhood. And I had known this man. I was 10 years old. I didn't quite understand what was all going on. I didn't quite understand what transsexuality was because, of course, then it was brand new. But as that story began to bloom, and it bloomed for years in my neighborhood, as Dawn, as she now is known, became this acquaintance down the street from me. And then she disappeared from town disappeared entirely for about a quarter of a century. And then for Ira, for a piece I did once, I found her.
Huh.
And that is what opens the show, the story of how I came to sort of tell the story of Dawn Langley Hall and become as what some people call the curator of the Dawn Langley Hall story. And that sort of informed my whole way of telling stories, that these wild, unlikely events existed just beyond the sort of periphery of our senses, you know, that our edited view of reality actually keeps a kind of lovely chaos at bay. And when we occasionally get a peripheral glimpse of that chaos, we're kind of secretly delighted. And that's a good story.
And they're all around.
Yeah, they're all around.
All the time.
Yeah. You know, my favorite comment on this show was that Mel Marvin, who's a Broadway composer, came to one of the workshops I did in New York when I was just first setting this up. And he said, you know, when he came out, he just said, you know, God, it just made me want to go home and write down like all of my stories. You know, like we all have these stories. But it's just that, you know, what brain scientists tell us is that most of the time we prefer to keep our sense of reality very conservative and contained because it's almost too terrifying to step out beyond sort of the conviction of our senses and get too much of a sense of that chaos.
The convictions are our senses. So again, it's our senses keeping us hemmed in.
That's right.
Building the fence.
That's right. And we know this now. I mean, there's been all these really cool brain science studies. Can I just list one? So there was one of those horrible incidents in Boston a few years ago where a cop got shot and all these cops descended on this neighborhood and were chasing the bad guys. And one of the cops chasing the bad guys was an African-American cop who was in plain clothes. He was undercover. And a bunch of the cops caught him, thinking he was one of the bad guys, and beat him almost to death, you know, one of these horrible things. Well, while that beating was happening, another cop named Kenneth Conley was pursuing one of the real bad guys, and he ran right past this beating. And later, you know, there's a huge thing. All the cops who had done the beating fled, and nobody got, you know, in trouble. And the only person who was known to have run past the beating was Kenneth Conley. And so they asked him about it. And he said, I didn't see anything. And so he was eventually tried and convicted. He went to prison. And one of these brain scientists did a study. He did this cool study where he got all these people. He couldn't believe it that the guy was saying, like, I literally didn't see it. I mean, he ran right past seven people beating the living crap out of a man. And he says, I didn't see it. That was his line. He didn't say, like, oh, I thought he had a gun or blah, 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 you know, the usual sort of made up excuses. No, no, I literally didn't see it. And so they did this experiment where they got a bunch of people to run through the woods chasing a jogger. You were supposed to just follow a jogger behind in the woods, right? And you're supposed to count how many times the jogger touched his hat, all right? Well, more than half the people who did this experiment did not see a completely staged human beating right off the trail. I mean, this is, in some of these cases, in broad daylight. Now, you're in the woods. You would think, like, if three people were beating the hell out of somebody right at your feet, you would see it. But almost three-quarters of the people who did this test did not see it.
What's the brain doing?
The brain actually has, and you know, it's one of our flaws, but it's also one of our kind of one of our gifts. Is our ability to focus and not see what we don't want to see allows us to essentially create this artificial world where we're looking for this kind of narrative. So if we're looking for the guy touching his hat, we literally just won't see anything out there.
Jack Kidd is talking about his show that's his one-person show. All right, you said something I have to come back to about your journalism, which is when you try to write down, capture real reality. Is that because there is the other kind of reality? So how are you, as a journalist, knowing you're either doing that or building in the flaws so that we get to what we need to get to, given all the misperceptions?
Right, right. Well, you know, the brain does have a fair sense of what reality is. In other words, there are plenty of these flaws, but they're sort of like around the edges of what we're perceiving. So it's not to say that, like, each brain is creating this, like, alternate reality and we're all living in, like, our own little headspace. I mean, that is true. But the fact is we do have a very common shared sense of reality. So I don't want to get into some, like, you know, Star Trek, you know, business about holodecks and whatever, because it's not that. We very much have a shared reality.
I'm glad you took us to Star Trek.
Yeah, right. Well, you got to go to Trek. You got to go to Trek at some point. You know? But the fact is that we do have this common reality, and we can be fair, maybe not objective. I think that whole idea of, like, being objective and that this hard rock, you know, bare truth that we can get to. We can't really get to that, but what we can get to is a kind of fair description of events, and that's really what a good journalist struggles to find.
Thank you, Jack Kidd.
Thank you.
More weekday to come.